From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories.
I'm Barbara Slavin, Washington correspondent for AllMonitor.com and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Joining me on the show this week are Hillary Krieger, an editor for the Washington Post's opinion section, and Jonathan Lande, national security and intelligence correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. And here are the issues. President Barack Obama announced that he's sending up to 300 additional U.S. troops to Iraq to advise the Iraqi government and provide intelligence about the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. Obama pressed Iraqis to form a more inclusive government to roll back insurgent advances and strongly implied that Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki should step down and allow a less polarizing figure to take his place. Deputy Secretary of State William Burns had a conversation with Iran about Iraq on the sidelines of nuclear negotiations in Vienna. But the U.S. was quick to insist that it was not about to coordinate militarily with Iran, even though both countries support the Iraqi government against the Sunni militants. U.S. Special Forces snatched a key suspect in the 2012 attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, that killed the ambassador, Chris Stevens, and three other Americans. Ahmed Abu Qatala was put on a U.S. Navy ship to be brought to the United States, where he is to stand trial in a federal court. And finally, in Ukraine, President Petro Poroshenko offered a ceasefire to pro-Russian separatists who've been creating havoc in the eastern part of the country. The offer, which Poroshenko discussed with Russian President Vladimir Putin, followed more bloodshed, including the deaths of several Russian reporters and the shooting down of a Ukrainian military transport plane, killing all 49 on board. Well, a quiet week in the news, Jonathan. I don't know where to start first. I guess we'll start with Iraq. President Obama made some remarks. He's basically doubling the number of U.S. forces in Iraq, if you count those sent in to provide extra security, moving people around from Baghdad to Erbil and so on. Is the U.S. getting back into Iraq in a serious way?
I think that what President Obama did was the minimal that he thought he should be doing. He obviously feels there's a need to stiffen the backs of the Iraqi army and its government and increase U.S. leverage in terms of trying to put pressure on Prime Minister Maliki to turn over the reins of government to, as you've put it, a less polarizing figure. But at the same time, let's not forget that Obama's number one constraint is the opinion of the American people, which is overwhelmingly against any kind of renewed U.S. intervention in that very sorry place. And I guess what he's being driven by in terms of sending these special forces are two things. One, the fact that he needs to stiffen the back of an army that's basically been in disintegration, as I said, also increase U.S. leverage over Maliki, but also because the terrorist group that's leading this Sunni insurgency, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, is a dangerous entity, is probably the most dangerous, wealthiest terrorist group in the world, having captured untold amounts of weaponry and vehicles, as well as hundreds of millions of dollars in cash in their takeover of the northern city of Mosul. So it is a real concern. And I guess he feels that he needs to do something because the territory that they've captured in Iraq has by magnitudes increased the amount of territory they control in Iraq and Syria, giving them more room in which to operate bases for the Westerners who are their members, who pose a terrorist threat should they come back to the United States and Europe.
Hillary, some of them have already gone back. Some of the fighters that worked with this group went back to Brussels and attacked a synagogue there. The irony, of course, that the U.S., one of the justifications for going into Iraq in the first place was that Saddam Hussein was somehow linked to al-Qaeda, which wasn't true. And now we have a giant haven for a group that's even worse than al-Qaeda.
Yes, of course, the George W. Bush backers and sort of conservative side say that at the same time, when you did see this type of al-Qaeda-type extremism explode in Iraq after the U.S. invasion, you saw American forces stay and take care of it. There was political action that also helped resolve that situation. So at least by the time that the U.S. was leaving, you had a more stable situation where that group wasn't such a threat. And now what you've seen is this metastasization of this organization really coming from the disintegration in Syria. And so the landscape has now changed, and you're seeing a lot of chaos, which is creating a real opening for, once again, the emergence of a really threatening group.
Now, of course, this is not just ISIS or ISIL, depending on your favorite acronym, but it is disgruntled Sunni groups, former Ba'athists, a lot of people. So to that extent, I mean, can you pin this on Maliki, Jonathan, and say that it's largely his fault? Can you pin it on the Iranians?
I think there's a lot of blame to go around. I think that obviously the White House wasn't paying a lot of attention to what was going on in Iraq. And given the fact that this group, ISIS, has been at the forefront of the civil war, hijacked a lot of the rebel operations, the rebel offensives inside of neighboring Syria, and was being warned that they were on the rise in Iraq, failed to, you know, use the leverage that the United States has, which is military assistance and aid, to push Maliki into being a more inclusive, creating a more inclusive government, and to stop the repression that he was pursuing against the minority Sunnis, and to settle his differences with the minority Kurds over their dispute on oil. That didn't happen. But I don't think there's any question that we want to start talking about who's to blame. We can blame the 2003 American invasion of Iraq, where there was no al-Qaeda before, and formed as a result.
Well, there was a tiny group, Ansar something, up in the north.
No, that was, those guys were not, I covered that part. I was up in the north at that point, and they were linked to al-Qaeda, but they really weren't a part of al-Qaeda. They hadn't sworn an oath of allegiance to Osama bin Laden. But be that as it may, once the Americans got in, then you had the formation of al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was the forerunner of ISIS. And, you know, I went back because of all of the, you know, the neocons who've, and former Bush people who have emerged from the woodwork to throw these charges at President Obama that it's his fault. And I looked at the last reports that the Pentagon did and the State Department did on the situation in Iraq at the end of the Bush administration, and it was by no means calm. Certainly, the number of attacks were down, the number of civilian deaths were down, but both reports noted continuing attacks and assassinations of judges, officials, police commanders. By no means was it a calm place. And so, yes, the failure of the Obama administration to pay sufficient attention to what was going, you can blame them for that. But they certainly do not share the lion's share. And I think Maliki and his policies, but who put Maliki where he is today?
That's true. Zalmay Khalilzad put Maliki where he is today in conjunction with the Iranians.
With Qasem Soleimani, who's the head of the
Al-Quds Force. So we had this interesting cooperation that goes back with the Iranians. That's another aspect that I've found quite fascinating, Hillary, in the criticism of the Obama administration. How dare he talk to Iran about Iraq? Well, given that George Bush didn't know the difference between a Sunni and a Shiite when he invaded Iraq, this has been reported, and given that the Iranians, of course, have been, up until now anyway, the major beneficiaries of the removal of Saddam Hussein, I wonder how you interpret these complaints now that we should not be allowing the Iranians to play a role in Iraq, given that they've been playing a major role in Iraq, certainly since 2003.
Right, and the United States has quietly worked with the Iraquis when it
with the Iranians
when it comes to Iraq, because there are shared interests, which often happens in the chessboard of the Middle East. You have enemies and enemies and enemies lining up to make a big circle that come back to people you need to work with. I think there's also the context of the Iran nuclear talks that are going on.
We'll
and so it's not in a vacuum. It's not simply the concept of talking to the Iranians, given all the enmity between the United States and Iran. It's the question of how does that change the calculation and implications for the nuclear talks that are going on right now, and is that going to hurt the U.S. in a really strategic sense and perhaps a more important venue? And I think that that's also, you know, influencing how people are seeing it. But, you know, there is a lot of blame to go around. Everybody wants to jostle for position. This is, you know, it's always unpopular if the United States is seen, you know, making nice in any way to Iran. So I think it's a good talking point for people who want to criticize Obama for what they're seeing unfolding in Iraq.
Jonathan, what do you think is going to happen? I mean, we're hearing that Baghdad will likely hold, but Baghdad is not 100% Shiite. There are still Sunni pockets there. This group, ISIS, has gotten very close. They appear to have taken over a key refinery, which provides gasoline and cooking oil and cooking gas and whatnot to Iraqis in Baghdad. Can Baghdad hold?
the conventional wisdom is that the group ISIS and its former Baathist and tribal supporters are overextending themselves because they don't have the numbers to hold the territory that they've taken. But at the same time, as you point out, there are some Sunni pockets still in Baghdad. To create trouble, you don't have to have a conventional military assault on the city. You can infiltrate a gunman and bombers in ones and twos into the city center and create total panic and confusion. And in that, you can end up taking hold of some of the Sunni sections of the city and trigger serious mayhem right in the seat of government of Iraq, which could, in fact, result in yet a continued disintegration of the Iraqi armed forces, which we paid a lot of U.S. tax dollars to build and train. So it's an outstanding question right now. As I said, the conventional wisdom is that they can't possibly do this, succeed in taking Baghdad because of the numbers, and the numbers mm-hmm. being that, you know, the number of Shia are so overwhelmingly more than Sunnis. But there are also three things we need to watch as well, three cities, the cities of Samarra, Najaf, and Karbala, which mm-hmm. house the holiest shrines in Shia Islam. The ISIS has sworn that it's going to destroy these shrines, and we know that the Iranians have said, those are our red lines. We will defend those shrines. So we have all the makings of an even greater crisis in the making here.
We haven't even talked about Syria in this, Hillary, but clearly this allows, one presumes, Bashar al-Assad to further consolidate in Syria while all this commotion is going on next door. I don't know if ISIS is sort of slowing down its activities in Syria so that it can concentrate on Iraq.
Right. I mean, I think that that's, you know, one of the things we see is that all of these things are connected. Yeah. So, you know, what happens one way is going to spill over, and then there's going to, you know, be back spillage. On the other hand, if you see a concerted effort to, you know, have the Iranians step up because they feel that lines have been crossed and they're strengthening, that's also going to play, you know, potentially into Bashar al-Assad's hands as well, because then he has another group that's working to counter this extremist group that's caused him a lot of trouble right now. I think that on the other hand, if you're drawing the United States in, the U.S. has been studiously avoiding getting involved in Syria. It's had many times when it's made gestures that it's going to be supporting Syrian opposition and really hasn't delivered on that. Now that you're talking about sending people into Iraq, their connections are incredibly clear to everyone. That could also mean that you're going to see more U.S. involvement when it comes to the Syrian opposition groups.
One last point, Jonathan, on Iraq, and then we'll move on, and that is that Kurds, of course, have swallowed up Kirkuk now. There's also a report they're actually selling the oil that was they've sent out to Turkey. There was even a report that some of this oil went to Israel, but I don't know if that's disinformation on Twitter or not. How do the Kurds come out of this, at least in the short term?
Right now, they're riding high. The collapse of the Iraqi army in the north around Mosul has allowed the Kurds to take full control of the oil city of Kirkuk, which was a disputed city that they claim and that they envision as being part of a dreamed of independent Kurdistan. They've also captured other territory, and they are fighting. There are places where they are fighting the Sunni insurrectionists. And you're right, there's all the potential now of the Kurds really pushing for independence, because they now control the oil fields in the north, and they have been trying to do deals with the Turks to try and sell major amounts of oil to the Turks. And they've been at odds with Prime Minister Maliki over this, because he insists that that revenue goes to the Iraqi state. The Kurds say, no, we get to keep some of that. As a result, there are two tankers filled with Kurdish oils that are floating around the Mediterranean without being able to find a buyer.
But maybe now they have.
Yeah, maybe now they have. There is word that perhaps Israel is going to buy it. We have to wait and see. But certainly this puts the Kurds in a really advantageous position to be able to say to Mr. Maliki, either you do a deal with us on this oil and you settle this dispute that's been going on for years now, or we're going.
Yeah, and it also gives them leverage to get Mr. Maliki to step down in favor of someone
else.
We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin, Washington correspondent for AllMonitor.com and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Joining me today are Hillary Krieger, editor at the Washington Post's opinion section, and Jonathan Lande, national security and intelligence correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com. Very briefly, let's talk about the Iran nuclear talks. Hillary, you started that topic. They've concluded another round. They've started drafting the agreement. They've agreed on the name for the agreement, which I must confess I don't have at the tip of my tongue right now. But there still appeared to be some very serious gaps. A, do you think they're going to make it by the July 20 deadline? And B, it seems as though they've been able to keep Iraq out of these discussions. Are they going to be able to continue to do that?
Right. I think that, as things unfold and the U.S. level of involvement becomes clear and how much the U.S. does try to work with Iran on this, I think that's going to be determined over the next few weeks as we get towards the July 20th deadline. I think it's unlikely there'll be a deal by that time. Yes, they seem to be making progress, but the issues that are outstanding are big ones. And of course, usually you're leaving the big ones till the end, and you count on the sort of the pressure of the clock ticking down to really get those gaps bridged. And there isn't that pressure. The agreement has a provision for another 6-month extension. While, both sides say they want this to get done, I don't think that there's sufficient urgency that you're really going to see the big, compromises that would need to take place to close the gaps in that short a time frame.
I'm going to differ with you there. I think that there is a lot of pressure to get it done because there's a concern in both countries that so-called hardliners will try to sabotage or hijack the process if they don't get a deal. Jonathan, Congress is chomping at the bit to try to pass, if not some new sanctions legislation, then resolutions that try to put Congress in the room with the negotiators. Also, this new crisis in Iraq is yet another financial drain on the Iranians, who have not gotten the sanctions relief that they had hoped for, even from the interim agreements. So what's your sense? Are they going to get there? And how does Iraq play with this nuclear issue?
Well, right now, the indications are that they have not been able to make much progress on the really thorny issues at stake here, the biggest one being the number of centrifuges, which are the machines that actually enrich uranium. The Iranians will be able to operate under the new agreement. They say they're not going to get rid of any. They want unlimited ability to operate centrifuges and maintain this secret site that will now not secret site anymore under a mountain outside of Qom, where they have centrifuges. The indications are actually that their unity has been maintained among the P5 plus one, the Europeans, on this issue, that they're not giving any ground. And I think that there is pressure on the Iranians. I think that Iraq has increased the pressure on the Iranians because they are stretched by the sanctions, but they're also stretched by the enormous role they're playing in Syria,
right,
which is not just in terms of providing manpower to advise and assist President Bashar Assad and his forces, which are stretched too. And I just got back from my second trip to Syria. But also the financial means that they're having to provide President Assad, which are crucial to him being able to maintain the sort of like this. He's created this sort of air of normalcy. It's a veneer of normalcy, but it's very important for him to be able to maintain the public support that he does maintain. And he does maintain a lot of public support still. And you've got the Iranians still having to support Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hezbollah operations inside of Syria. So they are under financial pressure, I think, to make this deal. But whether or not they're going to be able to, they're going to compromise to the extent that the United States and its partners are looking for, that's the question.
Yeah. One, you mentioned the unity among the P5 plus one. The really crucial bits that emerged in the recent talks were that Russia and China are also telling the Iranians they have to cut the number of centrifuges, that they simply cannot maintain the number. And when you consider that the Iranians have already won the principle that they can have an enrichment program, that's pretty big, that they got that concession under the interim agreement. So now we're in the souk, as they say, and it's a matter of, is it 10,000? Is it 5,000? Is it 3,000? What kind of centrifuge and how long the restrictions will apply? So they convene again July the 2nd, and I would assume, Hillary, they're going to stay in the room until they get an agreement. Certainly give it a very good effort.
Yeah, and I think, I agree, of course, that there's a lot of different pressure points that are operating. I just think that when we're talking about the fact that these are such huge differences and there's so much at stake, having any escape valve releases enough, a little bit of enough of that pressure to make the idea that, you know, you have that real gel to push everything together. I just think it raises a big prospect of that not actually happening. But I do think that there is not only sufficient pressure, but sufficient interest from both sides to find ways to come to a deal, that over the next few weeks, there are going to be a lot of steps, a lot of progress, I think, would be made. So it would set up, if there's a six-month extension,
we should point out that they're talking, you know, every day. They're communicating every day. It's not just waiting for meetings in Vienna. There are phone calls, emails, and so on among the negotiators on a routine basis, Jonathan.
And the word is, all this could actually be resolved, but at the last minute, once you bring the big guns back in, you know, obviously the Iranian foreign minister is there, but you don't have the foreign ministers of the P5 plus one there.
So they'll have to fly in at the last minute.
That's what's going to happen. You know, they all fly in the last minute, and in theory, there's going to be some kind of compromise reach, because I don't think the alternative is something that either side wants to contemplate at this point.
Yeah. And small plug for the Atlantic Council, we published two papers this week that show how to unwind U.S. and European sanctions against Iran in a way that could be conducive to an agreement. So I recommend that to our listeners. Let's move on to another interesting, the amount of news is just staggering. In the midst of all this craziness going on in Syria and in Iraq, we had news that nearly 2 years after our ambassador in Libya was murdered, U.S. Special Forces have just swooped in and picked up one of the key suspects. Hillary, apparently this gentleman, Mr. Abu Qatala, had spent a lot of his time in Benghazi giving interviews to journalists. So why did it take so long to extract him?
Well, I think that, you know, there's always, you need to balance. It's not just knowing the person and following their movements, but wanting to do it with absolutely no risk. I mean, if the United States goes in and there's any casualties, it's an absolute disaster. So I think that that's part of it. And there was a plan to do this almost a year ago. Mm-hmm. And because of another similar arrest that was broadcast on Twitter, the U.S. had to call off the operation because they thought that the advance notice was going to jeopardize the operation. So, I think there's a lot of there are a lot of different moving parts that come into play, and when you're out there in the media, it means you have a lot of journalists watching what's going on, and that can complicate. It can help in terms of access to information, but it can also really complicate planning purposes, what's going to happen on the ground. So,
yeah, I suppose you don't want to do your operation when this guy is having an iced coffee with the correspondent from The New Yorker in a cafe.
I think there's another factor that played here, and that is that, you know, Libya has been pretty much in turmoil ever since the ouster of and death of the late dictator Muammar Gaddafi. But the chaos right now is at a new high because of basically a revolt by a former general who used to live here in the United States, one General Haftar, who has unleashed and has a lot of loyalty within what remains of the Libyan armed services, who has unleashed this offensive against the Islamists who are based in Benghazi. And so there's a lot of chaos in Benghazi. There's a lot, and that kind of chaos provides a great deal of cover for the U.S. forces to be able to do the kind of operation they carried off while everyone else is paying attention to what's going on in the street. He was alone, apparently, in a house on the coast, and they were able to go in and snatch him with no gunfire exchange and no casualties.
You know, this diversionary aspect of all the other news that's going on in the world also has had, Hillary, a certain effect on the attention we're paying to Ukraine. The UN says that more than 350 people, including more than 250 civilians, have been killed since the new government came in. And yet it's disappeared from the front pages, but recent events were particularly bloody. Now we have an announcement of a possible ceasefire, but there's also news that the Russians are moving troops again close to the border with Ukraine. So how is this situation evolving? Are the Russians taking advantage? Is everyone taking advantage of the situation to try to settle scores? And is this going to get bloodier?
I think that given what we've seen over the course of this week, there's every indication that it will get bloodier. And I think partly that's because while you had dramatic events like, I mean, a military plane shot down, 49 right. people killed, and it was, you know, not on the front page of newspapers. It was, you know, not, I mean, this is a major, you know, act of war, an escalation. And when there isn't the attention on it, I think, you know, the forces that are likely to tamp down the violence, the United States and the rest of the West, if you don't have that sustained attention, you're much less likely to see a diminution of the violence in the short term.
And in the sense that everything's connected, Jonathan, the crisis in Iraq, of course, has caused oil prices to go up again, which, of course, helps Vladimir Putin, who is under some sanctions but is still able to sell his oil. Do you think he's thinking that under cover of Iraq, he can go back into eastern Ukraine and try to establish some more facts on the ground?
Well, it's obvious that he is taking advantage of the refocus of the world on what's going on in Iraq, because there's new evidence that the Russians are not only deploying more troops or returning their troops to the border, but that they've actually supplied heavy weapons in the form of tanks and rocket launchers to the pro-Russian separatists inside of Ukraine. This is a charge that the State Department has made, and NATO has provided overhead photographs purporting to show the movement of these vehicles. There's word of the Ukrainian troops having captured an APC, an armed personnel carrier, from the rebels with the registration of this vehicle at a base inside of Russia, a Russian military base. So there doesn't, and beyond all of that, of course, Gazprom, the big Russian gas supplier, has cut Ukraine off of its gas supplies in a dispute over how pricing. So every indication is that as much as the Russians say publicly that this needs to be solved diplomatically, they are continuing to pour fuel on that fire and seem to be doing it while the rest of the world is focused on Iraq.
We're coming toward the end, but one final note, really troubling factoid. The UN apparently has reported that there are now something like 50 million refugees globally from all of these various crises that we're watching. Of course, Syria has the largest number of refugees, but now I believe Iraq is sort of reaching the same level, especially if you include displaced people. Ukraine, so many places where people are absolutely being forced to leave their homes. And apparently this is the largest figure since World War II of refugees. So that is a sad commentary, I guess, on the state of the world.
It's sad and also dangerous. I mean, that's how you come into a lot of these conflicts, is when you have these different groups. And these are not rich countries anyway, and they have influx of foreigners who now are demanding resources. I mean, it also doesn't bode well for, you know, going forward.
Well, on that depressing note, I think we'll leave it this week and hope for better news the next time we meet. Thank you all so much for being with us. That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Hillary Krieger, an editor on the Washington Post's opinion section, and Jonathan Landay, national security and intelligence correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. This program was produced by Carol Castiel, and our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Barbara Slavin, Washington correspondent for AlMonitor.com and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Thanks for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.